Kitty, Chapter 35. Kitty did not cry. If her years in the resistance had achieved nothing else, they had succeeded in hardening her emotions. Weeping was no good to her now. The magnitude of the disaster was so great that normal responses were inadequate. Neither during the crisis in the Abbey, nor immediately afterwards, when she first halted her desperate flight in a silent square a mile away, did she allow herself to slump into self-pity. Fear drove her on, for she could not believe that she had escaped the demon. At every corner, using old resistance techniques, she waited 30 seconds, then peeped back the way she had come. On every occasion the road behind was empty of pursuit. She saw only slumbering houses, flickering lanterns, silent avenues of trees. The city seemed indifferent to her existence. The skies were filled with impassive stars and the blank-faced moon. There was no one out in the depths of the night, and no vigilant spheres abroad. Her feet made the faintest tripping sounds as she jogged along the pavements, keeping to areas of shadow. She heard little. Once a car humming past on a nearby road, once a distant siren, once a baby squalling thinly in an upper room. She still carried the staff in her left hand. In her first hurried shelter, a ruined basement of a tenement block within sight of the Abbey's towers, she had almost abandoned the staff under a pile of rubble. But useless though it was, good for nothing but killing insects, the benefactor had said, it was the only thing to have come out of the horror with her. She could not let it go. She rested a few minutes in the cellar, but did not allow herself to sleep. By dawn, central London would be swarming with police. It would be fatal to remain there. Besides, if she shut her eyes, she dreaded what she might see. Throughout the deepest hours of night, Kitty worked her way east along the bank of the Thames, before reaching Southwark Bridge. This was the most exposed and dangerous part of the whole journey, particularly with the staff in tow. She had heard from Stanley how magical objects radiated their nature to those with eyes to see, and she guessed that demons might perceive her burden from far across the water. So she waited in bushes beside the bridge for many minutes, plucking up her courage, before making the dash to the other side. As the first lights of dawn began to glow above the city, Kitty pattered under a little arch and into the mews courtyard where the weapons cellar was concealed. It was the only place she could think of to gain immediate shelter, and the need for this was pressing. Her feet were stumbling with weariness. Worse, she was beginning to see things, flashes of movement in the corner of her eye that made her heart pound. She could not go to the art shop, that was clear enough, with Mr. Pennyfeather, now, how vividly she imagined it, lying neatly stacked away for the authorities to find. Visiting her rented room was unwise, too. Kitty savagely returned to the practical business in hand, since magicians investigating the shop would learn of it and soon come calling. Blindly she located the cellar key. Blindly she turned it in the lock. Without pausing to switch on the electric light, she felt her way by sight down a number of twisting corridors until she reached the inner room, where the ceiling pipe still dripped into its overflowing bucket. Here she tossed the staff down, stretched out beside it on the concrete floor, and slept. She awoke in darkness, and lay there stiff and cold for a long time. Then she rose, felt for the wall, and switched on the single electric bulb. The cellar was just as it had been the afternoon before, when the others had been there too. Nick practicing his combat moves, Fred and Stanley throwing discs. She could still see the holes in the joist where Fred's disc had struck. Much good it had all done them. Kitty sat beside the pile of logs and stared at the opposite wall, hands lying loosely in her lap. Her head was clearer now, though rather light from lack of food. She took a deep breath and tried to focus on what she should do. This was hard, for her life had been turned upside down. For more than 3 years, her energies and emotions had helped to build the resistance. Now, in a single night, as if by a raging torrent, it had all been swept away. True, it had been a rickety enough construction at the best of times. None of them had agreed much on their strategies, and the divisions between them had grown bigger in recent months. But now there was nothing left at all. Her companions had gone. and with them the ideals they shared. But what were these ideals exactly? The events in the Abbey had not only changed her future, they had transformed her sense of the past, too. The futility of the whole affair now seemed transparent. The futility, and the foolishness, too. When she tried to bring Mr. Pennifeather to mind now, she saw not the principled leader she had followed for so long, but little more than a grinning thief, red-faced and sweating in the lantern light, rummaging through loathsome places in search of wicked things. What had they ever expected to achieve? What would the artifacts have truly accomplished? The magicians would not have been toppled, even with a crystal ball. No, they'd been kidding themselves all along. The resistance was nothing but a flea biting the ears of a mastiff. One swipe of a paw, and that was that. She drew the silver pendant from her pocket and stared dully at it. Grandmama Herneck's gift had saved her. Nothing more, nothing less. It was the purest luck she had survived at all. In her heart, Kitty had long known that the group was dying. But the revelation that it could so easily be snuffed out still came as an overwhelming shock. A single demon had attacked, and their resilience had come to nothing. All the group's brave words, all Mr. Hopkins' clever counsel, all Fred's boasting, all Nick's earnest rhetoric, was proved worthless. Kitty could hardly recall their arguments now. Her memories had been wiped clean by events in the tomb. Nick. The demon had said, Kitty had no difficulty bringing its words to mind, that it had killed 10 out of 12 intruders. Taking the historical victims into account, that meant Nick had survived too. Her mouth curled into a faint sneer. He'd got out so fast that she hadn't even seen him go. No thought from him of helping Fred, or Anne, or Mr. Pennifeather. Then there was the clever Mr. Hopkins. As she thought of the bland-faced scholar, a thrill of anger ran through Kitty. Where had he been all this time? Far away, safe and sound. Neither he nor the mystery benefactor, the gentleman whose information about Gladstone's defences had proved so sadly lacking, had dared be present at the tomb. If it hadn't been for their influence over Mr. Pennifeather in the last few months, the rest of the group would still have been alive that morning. And what had they got for their sacrifice? Nothing but a knobbly length of wood. The staff lay beside her, amid the debris on the floor. In a sudden flurry of rage, Kitty got to her feet, seized it in both hands, and brought it down hard over her knee. To her surprise, she achieved nothing but a jarring of both wrists. The wood was much stronger than it looked. With a cry, she hurled it against the nearest wall. Almost as soon as it began, Kitty's anger was replaced by a great emptiness. It was conceivable, perhaps, that she could contact Mr. Hopkins in due course, discuss a possible plan of action, but not today. For now, she needed something different, something to counteract the feeling of being utterly alone. She needed to see her parents again. It was already late afternoon when Kitty emerged from the cellar into the mews courtyard and listened. Faint sirens and one or two bangs sounded, drifting distantly on the wind from central London, where something was evidently afoot. She shrugged. So much the better. She would not be disturbed. She locked the door, hid the key, and set off. Despite travelling light, she had left the staff lying in the cellar. Kitty took most of the evening to walk to Balham, and the skies were darkening by the time she reached the familiar knot of roads close to her old home. By now she was tired, footsore, and hungry. Apart from a couple of apples stolen from a grocer's store, she had eaten nothing. Imagined tastings of her mother's cooking began to roll tantalizingly over her tongue, accompanied by thoughts of her old room, with its comfy little bed, and the wardrobe with the door that didn't close. How long had it been since she'd slept there? Years now. If just for one night, she would gladly curl up there again. Dusk was falling when she walked up the old street, and, slowing her pace unconsciously, drew near to her parents' house. A light was on in the living room. This drew forth a wrenching sob of relief, but also a spur of anxiety. Unobservant though her mother was, she must not guess something was wrong. Not until Kitty had a chance to work out what to do. She inspected herself in the blank reflection of a neighbour's window, smoothed back her tousled hair, and brushed down her clothes as best she could. She could do nothing about the dirt on her hands, or the bags beneath her eyes. She sighed. Not great, but it would have to do. With that, she stepped up to the door and knocked. Her keys had been left back in her rooms. After a slight delay, during which Kitty was driven to knock again, a familiar slim shadow appeared in the hall. It hovered halfway down it, as if uncertain whether to open the door. Kitty tapped on the glass.
"Mum, it's me."
Diffidently, the shadow came near. Her mother opened the door a little way and looked out.
"Oh," she said. "Kathleen." "Hello, Mum,"
Kitty said, smiling as best she could.
"Sorry this is unexpected." "Oh, yes."
Her mother did not open the door any further. She was looking at Kitty with a startled, slightly wary expression.
"Is anything wrong, Mum?"
Kitty asked, too weary to care.
"No, no, not at all." "So can I come in, then?" "Yes, of course."
Her mother stood aside to allow Kitty to enter, presented a cold cheek to be pecked, and shut the door carefully behind them.
"Where's Dad?" "In the kitchen. I know it's late, but I'm starving." "I think perhaps the living room would be best, dear." "Okay."
Kitty stepped down the hall and into the small lounge. Everything was much as she remembered. The frayed carpet, denuded of colour, the little mirror over the mantelpiece, the elderly sofa and chair that her father had inherited from his father, complete with lacy antimacassars on the headrests. On the little coffee table was a steaming teapot and three cups. On the sofa sat her father. In the chair opposite sat a young man. Kitty stopped dead. Her mother quietly closed the door. The young man looked up at her and smiled, and Kitty was immediately reminded of Mr. Pennyfeather's expression when he had looked upon the treasures of the tomb. It was a gleeful, acquisitive smile, struggling hard to be contained.
"Hello, Kitty,"
the young man said. Kitty said nothing. She knew what he was quite well.
"Kathleen."
Her father's voice was barely perceptible.
"This is Mr. Mandrake, from the Department of Internal Affairs, I believe." "That's right,"
Mr. Mandrake said, smiling.
"He wants..."
Her father hesitated.
"He wants to ask you some questions."
A sudden wail came from her mother's mouth.
"Oh, Kathleen,"
she cried,
"what have you been doing?"
Still Kitty did not reply. She had a single throwing disc in her jacket, but was otherwise defenceless. Her eyes flicked across to the drawn curtains over the window. It was a sash opener. She could climb out that way if her father had oiled the latch, or smash it at a pinch. The coffee table would go through it. Or there was the hall, with a choice of exits, but her mother was standing in front of the door. The young man gestured at the sofa.
"Would you like to sit down, Miss Jones?"
he said politely.
"We can discuss things in an agreeable manner, if you wish."
The edges of his mouth twitched.
"Or are you going to leap from the window at a single bound?"
By articulating the very thought that was running through her mind, the magician, intentionally or not, caught Kitty off guard. Now was not the time. She flushed, pursed her lips, and sat on the sofa, where she regarded the magician as calmly as she could. So this was the Mandrake whose servants had pursued the resistance for so many months. She would have known his profession a mile off. His clothes were the giveaway. A long black coat, a ridiculously tight black suit, shiny patent leather shoes. An outsized red handkerchief rose up from his breast pocket like a leaf of coral. His hair grew long about his face, which was thin and pale. Kitty realized for the first time how very young he truly was, still in his teens. Certainly no older than she, perhaps considerably younger. As if to offset this, he had steepled his hands in an assertive manner, legs crossed, one foot twitching with the motion of a lap-cat's tail, and adopted a smile that would perhaps have been urbane had his eagerness not kept showing through. His youth gave Kitty a little confidence.
"What do you want, Mr. Mandrake?"
she asked, in a level voice. The magician reached out, picked up the nearest cup and saucer, and took a sip of tea. With ostentatious care, he placed the ensemble down upon the armrest of his chair and arranged it carefully. Kitty and her parents watched him in silence.
"Very nice, Mrs. Jones," he said at last. "A very tolerable beverage. Thank you for your worthy hospitality."
This pleasantry elicited only a small sob from Kitty's mother. Kitty did not look at her. Her gaze was fixed on the magician.
"What do you want?" she said.
This time he replied.
"Firstly, to tell you that you are, as of this moment, under arrest."
"On what charge?"
Kitty knew her voice was shaking.
"Well, let me see."
The steepled fingers tapped together, beating out the list.
"Terrorism?
Belonging to an outlaw group?
Treachery against Mr. Devereux, his government, and the Empire? Vandalism? Wanton damage of property? Conspiracy to murder? Malicious theft? Desecration of a sacred resting place? I could go on, but it would only distress your mother. It is a melancholy situation that two such honest, loyal parents should have been cursed with a daughter like you." "I don't understand," Kitty said levelly. "These are serious charges. What is your evidence?" "You have been witnessed in the company of known criminals, members of the so-called resistance."
"Witnessed? What does that mean? Who says so?"
"Kathleen, you stupid girl, tell him the truth," her father said.
"Shut up, Dad."
"These known criminals," the magician went on, "were found this morning lying dead in a vault in Westminster Abbey, which they had previously ransacked. One of them was a Mr. Pennyfeather, whom I believe you work for."
"I always knew he was a bad lot,"
Kitty's mother whispered. Kitty took a deep breath.
"I regret to hear this, but I can hardly be expected to know everything my employer got up to in his own private time. You'll have to do better than that, Mr. Mandrake."
"Then you deny associating out of hours with this Pennyfeather?"
"Certainly I do."
"What about his fellow traitors? Two youths, Fred and Stanley by name?"
"Many people worked for Mr. Pennyfeather part-time. I knew them, but not well."
"Is that it, Mr. Mandrake? I don't believe you have any proof at all." "Well, if it comes to that..." The magician sat back in his chair and grinned. "One might ask why your clothes are so covered in green stains. It almost looks like grave mould when seen in a certain light. One might ask why you were not at your employer's shop this morning, when it was your duty to open the doors. One might possibly draw attention to documents that I have just been reading in the Public Records Office. They relate to a certain trial, Kathleen Jones versus Julius Tallow, a most interesting case. You have a previous criminal record, Miss Jones. Find a considerable sum for an attack on a magician. And then, not least, there's the witness who saw you fencing stolen goods in the company of the sadly deceased Fred and Stanley, a witness whom you attacked and left for dead."
"And who is this precious witness?" Kitty snarled. "Whoever he is, he's lying."
"Oh, I think he's very reliable." The magician gave a little chuckle and pushed the hair back from the sides of his face.
"Remember now?"
Kitty looked at him blankly.
"Remember what?"
The magician's forehead wrinkled.
"Well, me, of course."
"You?
Have we met before?"
"You don't recall? Well, it was several years ago. I admit I was different then."
"Less foppish, perhaps?"
Kitty heard her mother give a faint moan of distress. The sound had as little effect on her as if it had been uttered by a stranger.
"Don't cheek me, girl."
The magician recrossed his legs, with some difficulty owing to the tightness of his trousers, and smiled thinly.
"Mind you, why not? Fire off all the cheap comments you like. It won't make any difference to your fate."
Now that the end had come, Kitty found she had no fear. Only an overwhelming sense of irritation at the jumped-up youth sitting opposite. She folded her arms and looked him fully in the face.
"So go on, then," she said.
enlighten me. The boy cleared his throat. Perhaps this will refresh your memory. 3 years ago, in North London, one cold December night. No, he sighed. An incident in a back alley? Kitty shrugged wearily. I've had a lot of incidents in alleys. You must have got a forgettable face. Ah, but I never forgot yours.
His anger leaped to the surface now. He leaned forward in his seat, knocking the cup with an elbow and spilling tea upon the chair. His eyes flashed guiltily at Kitty's parents.
Oh, sorry.
Kitty's mother launched herself at the spot, dabbing with a napkin.
Don't worry, Mr. Mandrake. Please don't worry.
You see, Miss Jones, the magician went on, lifting the cup off the chair arm so that Kitty's mother could dab around it more effectively.
I never forgot you, though I saw you only for a moment. Nor I did not forget your colleagues, Fred and Stanley, since it was they who robbed me, they who tried to kill me.
Robbed you?
Kitty frowned.
What did they take?
A valuable scrying glass.
Oh.
A dim memory swam into Kitty's mind.
You were that kid in the alley. The little spy. I remember you now. And your glass.
That was a shoddy piece of work.
I made that. We couldn't even get it to start.
Mr. Mandrake gathered himself with difficulty and spoke in a dangerously controlled voice.
I notice that you have stopped denying the charges.
Oh, yes, Kitty said, and as she did so, felt more consciously alive than she had done for many months.
They're true, all right. All of what you said, and more. I'm only sorry it's all over now. No, wait, I deny one thing. You said I left you for dead in that alley. That isn't so. Fred would have cut your throat, but I spared you.
Heaven knows why, you miserable little sneak. I should have done the world a favour.
She doesn't mean this.
Her father had leapt to his feet and was standing between them, as if his body would shield the magician from his daughter's words.
Oh, but she does. She does.
The boy was smiling, but his eyes danced with rage.
Go ahead. Let her talk.
Kitty had barely paused for breath.
I despise you and all the other magicians. You care nothing for people like us. We're just here to provide your food and clean your houses and make your clothes. We slave away in your factories and workshops while you and your demons live in luxury. If we cross your paths, we suffer, like Jacob did. You're all callous and wicked and heartless and vain.
Vain?
The boy adjusted the tilt of his handkerchief.
How wonderfully hysterical. I'm just well turned out. Presentation's important, you know.
Nothing's important to you. Get off me, Mum!
In her fury, Kitty had got to her feet. Her mother, half maddened by distress, was clutching at her from the side. Kitty pushed her away.
Oh, she snarled. And if you want a tip on presentation, those trousers are far too tight.
Is that so? The boy rose too, his coat billowing about him. I've heard enough. You'll be able to refine your sartorial opinions at leisure, in the Tower of London.
No!
Kitty's mother sank to the floor.
"Please, Mr. Mandrake!"
Kitty's father stood as if his bones pained him.
"Is there nothing we can do?"
The magician shook his head. "I'm afraid your daughter has long since chosen her path. I regret it for your sakes, since you are loyal to the state."
"She has always been a headstrong girl,"
Kitty's father said quietly. "But I never realized she was wicked, too.
That incident with Jacob Hernick should have taught us something. But we always hoped for the best, Iris and me. And now, with our armies going off to war in America, and threats as never before on every side, to find our girl's a traitor, neck deep in crime. Well, it's broken me, it really has, Mr. Mandrake. I always tried to bring her up right."
"I'm sure you did,"
the magician said hastily. "Nevertheless,
I used to take her to watch the march pasts, see the soldiers during the festivals. I had her on my shoulders on Imperial Day, when the crowds in Trafalgar cheered the Prime Minister for an hour. You might not remember that, Mr. Mandrake. You're so young yourself, but it was a grand occasion. And now that daughter of mine's gone, and in her place is this surly vixen, who's got no respect for her parents, her betters, or her country."
There was a catch in his voice as he finished.
"You really are an idiot, Dad," Kitty said.
Her mother was still half kneeling on the floor, beseeching the magician.
"Not the tower for her, Mr. Mandrake, please."
"I'm sorry, Mrs. Jones. "'It's all right, Mum.' Kitty did not hide her contempt. "'You can get off your knees. He won't be taking me to the tower. I don't see how he can.'
"'Oh, yes?' The boy looked amused. "'You doubt that, do you?'
Kitty peered into the far corners of the room. "'You seem to be alone.' A faint smile.
"'Only in a manner of speaking. Now then.
An official car waits in the next street.
Are you going to come with me quietly?'
"'No, Mr. Mandrake, I am not.'
Kitty launched herself forward, swung a fist. It caught the boy on his cheekbone with a dull crack. He capsized, sprawling into the chair. Kitty stepped over her prone mother and made for the door, but a firm grasp on her shoulder jerked her back. Her father, white-faced, eyes blank and staring.
"'Dad, leave off!'
She wrenched at his sleeve, but his grip was iron-strong.
"'What have you done?'
He looked at her as if she were something monstrous, an abomination.
"'What have you done?' "'Dad, just let me go. Please, just let me go.'
Kitty struggled, but her father only gripped the harder. From her position on the floor, her mother reached out to clutch Kitty's leg half-heartedly, as if uncertain whether she intended supplication or restraint. Over in the chair, the magician, who had been shaking his head like a fuddled dog, turned his gaze towards them. His eyes, when they focused, were venomous. He spoke a few harsh syllables in a strange tongue and clapped his hands. Kitty and her parents stopped their struggle. A brackish vapour seeped from nowhere into the air. At its heart, a dark form, blue-black, with slender horns and leathery wings, appraising them with a wicked leer. The magician rubbed the side of his jaw and flexed it.
"'The girl,' he said. "'Secure her and don't let her go.' You may grasp her hair as painfully as you wish.
The creature chirruped harshly in answer, beat its wings, and flew out of its vapour nest. Kitty's father gave a low moan. His grasp on Kitty's shoulder loosened. Her mother flung herself back against the corner of the dresser and hid her face.
"'Is that the best you can do?' Kitty said. "'A moolah? Please!'
She stretched out a hand, and before the startled creature could even reach her, seized it by its neck, swung it round her head a few times, and threw it back into the magician's face, where it burst with a flatulent sound. An eruption of purple, bitter-smelling droplets peppered his suit and coat, and the surrounding furnishings. He cried out in shock. Reaching for his handkerchief with one hand, he made a mystic sign with the other. Instantly a small, red-faced imp appeared at his shoulder, bounded onto the dresser, and opened its mouth. A bolt of orange flame shot out at Kitty, catching her on her chest and knocking her back against the door. Her mother screamed. Her father cried out. The imp capered with triumph, and stopped, mid-caper. Kitty was straightening up, dusting off her smouldering jacket and staring at the magician with a grim smile. With a quick movement, she drew her throwing disc from her jacket and flourished it. The magician, who had lurched towards her in his fury, stepped hurriedly back.
"'You can wear the tightest trousers you please, Mr. Mandrake,' she said. "'But the fact remains you're a conceited small-timer. "'If you follow me, I'll kill you. Goodbye. "'Oh, and don't worry, Mum, Dad.'
"'She turned to look at each one calmly. "'I won't ruin your reputation any further. "'You won't see me again.' "'With that, and leaving parents, magician, and imp staring at her back, "'she turned, opened the door, and passed through. "'Then she walked slowly and deliberately up the hall,' and out of the front door into the warm evening. In the street she chose a direction arbitrarily and walked off, never looking behind her. Only when she had rounded the nearest corner and had begun to run did her tears finally begin to flow.